Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Probably the shocked the public the most, probably the money laundering side of things, that DEA is so involved in attacking money laundering with undercover operations and how they use undercover money laundering operations to identify networks, get on the drug side of things, and really have major impact on criminal organizations. I don't think that, although you hear a lot about money laundering, I don't think the public is so aware of the breadth of some of the undercover stuff that's done in New York and LA and everywhere, probably everywhere.
I'm Steve Murphy, DEA special agent retired and now host of the Game of Crimes podcast. If you've seen the Netflix series Narcos, then you know my story. I now bring you stories of heroism and bravery from our law enforcement and military heroes, and occasionally from the criminals that they faced. Welcome to Game of Crimes. Billy, in 32 years with the Drug Enforcement Administration, tell us about the operation that never made the news, that never became famous. But when you look back today, you think, man, that was the case that changed everything for me.
Ooh, I mean, that's a pretty easy one for me, Steve. 1995, it was a case on a Mexican transportation group in L.A. And at that time, it was kind of a transitional time in L.A., the early 90s. 1995 was at the tail end of it. But when I started in 92, really, there weren't a lot of wiretap investigations in L.A., and no one really wanted to do them. And one of the big transitions I went through early in my career was kind of moving into that wiretap area, clone cell phones, et cetera. And I did a case in 1995 on this Mexican transportation group that was bringing in huge amounts of cocaine, and they were using encrypted cell phones in 1995. It was a little add-on device. They bought it at like a spy shop or something, and they would get on the phone and just whistle. And that meant the guy would kind of hit the button, and all we heard is this garbled noise. And we had a guy named Charlie who was, I think he was National Guard, Marine Corps National, or something like that. He had been in the Marine Corps, then he was in California National Guard, and he got assigned to work with us. And he's like, I can break that encryption. And oh, wow. he went to the spy shop and bought the same kind of device that these guys had. And I don't know what he did, Steve, but he made something where we would take, and this is back in the days of cassettes, we would record the wiretaps on cassettes. So you would have this cassette tape of this jumbled conversation, put it in this machine, plug this device into the speaker of the cassette recorder, and all of a sudden it would be pretty clear and you could actually hear, understand what they were saying.
Holy cow.
But that case was big for me because it gave me a strategy. I learned how to attack the problem from that case. And what we would do is we'd go up on this group of Mexican traffickers that were bringing the cocaine across the border. At that time, it was cocaine and weed.
Yep.
And we'd identify the Colombians that they were passing the drugs off to, a couple hundred kilos at a time. And then what we would do is stay up on those Colombians and take the Mexican cell down. And then we would just wait. And then a new Mexican group would pop up and we'd get back on them from the Colombians. And then we would take the Colombians down. And then we would just sit and wait on the Mexicans until they, so it was like a seesaw. We just kept bumping back and forth between these two groups. And I said, man, for that time, with that kind of problem set that we had, that was a fun strategy. It would never end. You could literally work it forever and be on new groups, and you could take stuff down and give discovery. And it was, you'll remember those days, the Colombians knew nothing about the Mexicans that were supplying them the cocaine. So you gave them all the discovery. It didn't matter. It wasn't going to compromise what you were doing on the other side. So that was a fun case and kind of gave me a strategy, which I worked for a couple of years after that.
Well, and let me tell you, you made one heck of a name for yourself. And ladies and gentlemen, it's my honor to welcome our guest here today, a 32-year veteran with the Drug Enforcement Administration, started out as a street agent, worked his way all the way up to the special agent in charge of the Los Angeles Field Division, which is one of our largest field divisions, one of our busiest field divisions. And when I was in special operations as an ASAC, the Los Angeles Field Division spent more money on wiretaps than New York, than Miami, probably more than most divisions added together, which was always a challenge.
Yes, it was.
Because we had to be accountable for every penny we spent.
Hey, Steve, I heard the term exit strategy a couple times in those years.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing how these trendy words come out and they expect you to listen to them, right?
Yeah. Follow them.
What that was all about was trying to save money, not putting people in jail. And that's just frustrating when you're one out, the guys are trying to make the case. But Billy here, and this is Bill Bodner, William Bodner, we call him Bill or Billy. Since he's retired from DEA, which was just a few years ago, he is a consultant. He's still an investigator. He does public education on drugs and fentanyl. So he's still living up to his oath. You folks hear me talk about that all the time. Just because we retire does not mean that our oath expires. He has a podcast of his own. He's a co-host on the Truth Nation podcast. Encourage you to go give that a listen. That's Truth Nation podcast. And now, and this is the best part. I just got goosebumps getting ready to tell this, Bill. He is a technical advisor and an actor on HBO's successful series Euphoria.
That's pretty crazy.
I'm just so excited for you, Billy. So, man, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and welcome to Game of Crimes.
Thank you, man. Thank you for the invitation, man. I love this show, and I've been a fan of you since back in the day, so it's great to be here.
Well, we figured out how to work the system and make cases and get their money.
Yep.
Oh, man, I'm so excited to have you on here. It's another legend in the world of the Drug Enforcement Administration. You're looking at him right now, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about Mr. Bodner here. It's just so many things that he did. Like to go to Special Operations Division, you needed what they were looking for is people with a strong wiretap background. I got there in, when did I get there? 90, I got back.
96, 98. Maybe 98.
No, I got there in 01. I got there 3 weeks before 9/11. I had done one wiretap in my case in Greensboro, or in my career in Greensboro, North Carolina, which turned out to be just a cluster type case, if you folks know what I'm talking about. But my ASAC at the time was a legend in DEA also. His name was Joe Keefe. Joe, I don't know. I guess he recognized that I'd work my butt off for trying to get the job done, which that's how you're successful, strong work ethic. And he brought me into SOD. And this is how I got to meet the legends in the field that know. Do you have any idea how many wiretap cases you did in your career?
No, I don't. I mean, pretty much the first one, it was 93 and did it. I became a supervisor in 2002. So in that whole time, that's pretty much all I did. And then even as a supervisor, when you and I got a little more involved with each other, our group was heavy into wiretaps.
Yeah. Would you, I know it's hundreds. Would you think it was over 1,000?
No. I mean, if you counted when I was a supervisor, yes. But I think probably hundreds that I did. Yeah. That was my thing. That was definitely my thing. And Steve, I don't know if it's first off, one thing you said is, started out as a street agent. I think all of us like to think that we kept that mentality throughout our careers.
Yeah.
I hope that when I was a SAC even, I had the mentality of a street agent. It's not for me to say. You'd have to ask the people that worked in the office. Hopefully that stayed.
You know what? When you were the SAC there, I didn't hear any complaining coming out of LA that this new SAC sucks or anything like that. I think people knew you, brother.
That's good. And the other thing is, you talk about a strong work ethic. I think it's almost, and man, I had a conversation with Bill Mokler once in 1997. And I don't know if it's a strong work ethic or an addiction. And for me, to be honest, Steve, for me, it was a little bit of an addiction, not necessarily the healthiest thing, like any addiction's not, but it was so fascinating to me, right? Like I'm listening to these criminals and I'm learning everything about them. And that kind of just became, an addiction to where you could almost, or I would hope that I could almost predict what was going to happen after doing it enough. Yep. So it just become, and that's one thing that I started to say, I connected with Mokhleron. He came to LA because we had just done this crazy case in 97, and the circumstances of it were just, I don't know, like you could look at it and you could say, oh, that was incredibly lucky. And I forget who he brought. There was someone else who came. It was probably the chief of operations came with Bill Mokler or something. And there's three of us sitting in this conference room. And he's asking me to explain what happened. And I tell him what happened. And the one guy that was with him said, man, that was pretty lucky, pretty good stroke of luck there. And Mokler just kind of smiled. And he looked at me across the table. And I never forget what he said. He said, Bodner, it's like the junk, isn't it? And I knew what he was saying. Like the junk was the old term for heroin.
Yep.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, he's not wrong. Like, it was an addiction. The work was like an addiction. And he said, just keep doing what you're doing. The guy that was with him was like, well, you got to be diversified and you got to learn how to do other stuff and everything. And Mokler was just kind of shaking his head. He said, Bodner, just keep doing what you're doing. It's like the junk, isn't it?
He's also a legend. He is the reason that Special Operations Division started in DEA.
Yep.
So it's funny too, you mentioned about the addiction, because the regular listeners here, they've heard me talk about my first undercover case with DEA in 88, going to the Turks and Caicos Islands. Been a cop for 12 years before I became a Fed. The most cocaine I'd ever seen at one time prior to that was 2 ounces. 2 ounces, a little baggie. First undercover case, we went to Turks and Caicos and picked up 400 kilos of coke.
Woo.
So from 2 ounces to 880 pounds, and I make the claim I was addicted to cocaine at that point, just in a different way.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah.
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 So let's talk a little bit about your background, Billy. Where did you grow up? What kind of kid were you growing up? Were you a troublemaker? Were you a fighter, an athlete? Were you the class clown?
I was a little bit of a class clown and got in a little bit of trouble. I was born in Massachusetts. I lived in a little town called Everett. And then moved to, really, I would say when people ask me, where'd you grow up? New Jersey. That's really where I grew up. That's where I went through like middle school and high school. I did get in a little bit of trouble. Had a couple encounters with the police that weren't too bad. And I think, tell me if you think I'm right, I think at that time, that wasn't necessarily a bad thing when becoming a DEA agent. Because you had, I think, what made DEA very unique back then is the people were a little bit of an edge, street smarts.
Yep. What about your mom and dad? Did you have law enforcement in your family? Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, no one. I have an older brother, older sister. No, my parents, none of them involved in law enforcement.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you think that encounter with the cops when you were younger, did that leave an image in your mind?
I mean, it did not motivate me to get into law enforcement. No, it definitely left an image in my mind, but it wasn't, that was not what, I don't think that's what got me.
Well, what about, did you play any sports in school?
Yeah, I did. I played sports, baseball, really just baseball. That was it. I didn't really even have a thought about getting into law enforcement until I was in college, Steve. And really not until my senior. Now, keep in mind, this is the '80s. So you remember firsthand what was happening in the '80s, South Florida, George Bush Jr., right? The South Florida task force and all that stuff. That was big. That was really big news back then. And my senior year of college, they're lining up interviews on campus, and I was a business major studying finance, and I'm going on these interviews that they set up, and there was one for a brokerage company I'll never forget. And at the end of the interview, the guy says, so you could see yourself doing this for the rest of your life. And I'm thinking about it, and I'm like, no, to be honest with you, not really. And I guess it was a moment where I had a realization, like, hey, there's nothing wrong with being someone that works in a cubicle, so to speak, right? 9 to 5. But that's not really what I was into. I wanted something that was going to be a little more exciting and like I said, DEA was so much in the news then, and the drug issue was so much in the news. It just looked like a lot of fun. And I kind of said, hey, that's what I want to do.
And where'd you go to college at?
University of Delaware, a blue hen.
Blue hen.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means.
That's their mascot. Actually, it's the only college I got into too. So I didn't have a lot of choice. If I was going, that's where I was going.
Yeah. But then when you graduated there in 89, you continued your education, didn't you?
Yeah. So here's what happened. I applied to DEA immediately when I got out of college. I applied to DEA and I immediately got a rejection letter, like within, I don't know, weeks, whatever time frame the government could do back then. Hiring was even slower then than it was now. So I got rejected right away, and I was living in New Jersey. I called the recruiter in Newark, New Jersey, someone who you may have known, Becky Bojeski.
Did not.
Okay, so credit to her. She actually took the time to speak with me. And I kind of said, hey, I understand. Like, I've not done anything with my life. I'm a college graduate with no experience doing anything. What are you looking for? And she went through, hey, we look for people with prior law enforcement or at that time military, or we're looking for accountants. And I thought, I hung up and I said, hey, I've just done 4 years of college. In college, I actually learned how to study and I learned how to be a student. In high school, I had no concept of that. I just kind of winged it, like probably a lot of us did.
Right.
So I thought, hey, I can probably go back to school, get an MBA in accounting, and make myself more marketable to DEA. So I spent a couple of years doing that, and I applied again. And I don't remember exactly when I applied again. It was when I was almost done with graduate school, and I got in. I luckily got in. So really, credit to the recruiter for kind of taking the time to have that conversation with me and tell me what I could do to make myself more marketable to DEA.
Right, not just blow you off.
Exactly, which, I mean, I'm sure that happens a lot. Even today, I'm sure that happens a lot. People just get blown off.
Did you consider any other agencies besides DEA?
Not really. I remember taking the Treasury Enforcement Exam. Like at that time, ATF was Treasury. I think Secret Service was Treasury at that time. I probably didn't do very well on it. Don't remember. But I really never, I don't think I applied anywhere else but DEA.
You know, I took that same Treasury test and got a letter back and said, hey, you don't qualify to be an IRS agent. I'm thinking, good, I don't want to be IRS.
I probably got the same letter.
Yeah. So you're living in Jersey and you went through the FBI Academy there at Quantico, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And hey, I sometimes use that to my advantage, Steve, when I'm talking to FBI people.
Absolutely.
I'll say, oh yeah, I was a federal agent. I went in the FBI Academy in 92, and all of a sudden I sound like one of them.
And for all our brothers and sisters out there from the Bureau, we love you. We're going to bust your chops, but we're going to love you.
Of course. That's how it is.
So when you're in the academy, I mean, our regular listeners have heard me talk about writing memos when we do something that the instructors think we might not have done correctly, or we challenged them, we should have kept our mouth shut. Did you have to write any memos?
I wrote memos. And Steve, here's the thing. Like, here's who my peers were in the academy. My roommate was Keith Bishop.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he's my roommate in the academy. So I'm roommates with a guy who's played in the Super Bowl. The guy next door is like Joe Evans, who's...
Oh my gosh.
I think during the time at the academy, he was promoted to major or captain in the Marine Corps. So I'm with all these people who have quite the life accomplishments. And who am I? Like, should I really even have been there is debatable. But yeah, I definitely wrote some memos. And so here's another part of that, Steve. I haven't told this story too much, but when a year before or some number of months before I actually got the hiring offer, I got a message on my old school answering machine, and it was this woman in recruiting at DEA headquarters, and she said, hey, we want to put you in this class. And literally, I called her back 10 times a day for like 3 weeks straight and could not ever reach her. So I'm like, WTF, like you called me and kind of said, like, call me back. We're going to put you in this class, and nothing. And months then went by, and I'm like, well, what is this all about? So I talked to somebody I knew from my hometown who was a DEA agent, Pat Callahan, PJ Callahan, was an agent in New York.
Yeah.
And he's like, Bill, HR is so effed up. Like, he goes, you got to call a senator or something. You got to call your local representative and get them on this, because if they offered you a job and the only thing prohibiting you from getting the job is that this woman won't answer the phone or get back to you. So I wrote a letter to Bill Bradley. He was like, I don't even know you, a senator or a rep. And I was pretty naive, Steve. Like, I didn't know what the repercussions of that were going to be, but I guarantee you, I got the job offer shortly after sending that letter, but the people at the academy weren't too thrilled that I had done that. And a couple of them even asked me about it. And I said, well, hey, I don't know. This is what PJ Callahan, he told me to do that. Like, I didn't know that was something that I shouldn't have done. So I had a little bit of, I don't want to say a target on me, but I was being watched pretty close. Like, I don't think they were thrilled that this new kid with no real life experience except a couple college degrees had called a representative and got Congress involved in this issue. But hey, I'm glad I did it, because I got a job, and 32 years later, here I am. So well worth it.
Lack of professionalism on their part results in things like that happening.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's what it boils down to. But so you got to give us one good story of why you had to write a memo.
I remember on the range picking up brass and kind of doing it like I was talking to a dog. Here, brassy, 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 like walking around. Here, brassy, where are you? Come here, brassy, brassy, brassy. And again, it's definitely not a big deal, but when they're already kind of like, who the F is this guy? That was a memo that I had to write.
Yeah, my first memo came from the range also.
Yeah.
And I'd been shooting a lot of competition, and I was a very good shot. And that the first time we got revolvers when I came through the academy,
right?
And they're like, on the 5 yard line, they said, okay, six rounds, slow fire, try to hit that piece of paper in front of you at 5 yards. So I had one hole, and the instructor comes running up and he's like, you see that? You get credit for one. That's five misses in one round. I started laughing. I said, are you kidding me? He said, are you questioning me? And I said, yeah, I shoot competition. They're in there. I promise you. He said, I want you to write me a memo and explain to me why you're being insubordinate and why you think there's six holes in that paper. I'm like, really?
Right.
I've been caught for 12 years. I'm thinking, well, how about if I just smack you right here? But then I lost my job.
Right, right. Hey, as you know, Steve, that's the point of the academy, right?
Exactly.
This guy's, they're going to chop you down a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And you end up having a lot of fun. Where did you want your first assignment coming out of the academy? Where did you want to go?
I was 100% sure, and again, this goes back to the way I got hired, Steve, but I was 100% sure I was going to New York.
Yeah.
Because New York was short. I lived right there. Boom, boom, boom. And I did give them the out, though, because I said, like, I think at that time, so people know, we had to write down three choices.
Right.
Right. We wrote down three choices, turned it in, and you got what you got. So I think I put Newark, New Jersey, where I got hired. Hey, I could live with mom and dad and save some money.
Right.
By the way, I found my offer letter, and I made $13 an hour starting, basically. It was $26,000 a year at that time, which is $13 an hour in 1992. So I said Newark, New Jersey, number one, New York City, number two, and then I just put West Coast, which... But Steve, I was so sure I was going to be in New York. And I just thought, hey, I'm not really a middle America person. I like to be near the beach, near the ocean. So my third choice was West Coast. And they saw that. And again, probably because of the way I maneuvered into that job, they were like, oh, yeah, he said West Coast. We're going to give him Los Angeles. No one was more shocked than I to see Los Angeles on the.
Oh, that'd been hilarious to see your face when you opened the envelope.
Yeah.
That is a shock.
Yeah.
And then, so for the next 32 years, you stayed on the West Coast, right?
Pretty much. You know, I did a stint for 3 years at SOD, 2006 to 2009, which was a lot of fun, a great Headquarters does serve a purpose.
It does.
It allows you to kind of just be with your peers and not deal with the HR stuff so much, the supervision of people, which is a big, big challenge. None of us got, well, I shouldn't say that, but most of the people that are DEA agents didn't get into the job to be personnel managers, right? Right. And then all of a sudden, that's where we find ourselves. So that was kind of good to get out of that and to do some pretty, pretty cool, fascinating stuff there.
Worldwide operations.
And yeah,
the biggest thing for me was I ended up being there for 5 years and the networking. I mean, all of a sudden you've got friends all around the world. When I came out of SOD, I ended up in Atlanta as a strike force director command, whatever they call it. Uh-huh. As an ASAC, and the young agents, they'd come in and tell me about cases, and I'd say, well, listen, why don't you call so-and-so in Bangkok or this person in Colombia or this person in London? And then they would look at you and like, how in the world can you know all these people? But when I was a young agent in Miami, the senior agent would say, hey, Murph, call so-and-so here or over there. And I'm like, and I had the same question. How do you do that?
Uh-huh.
But that was the benefit of going to headquarters for me was the people you met and the friendships you made.
And it's not... just to kind of add something to that, it's not just you're calling someone in the office. You're calling someone who you know, and there's probably a reason why you know that person. I mean, I had that experience being in L.A. There was Joe Evans in Miami, Brian Crowell in New York, and Mike McDaniel in Houston. Like, those were the guys. And anytime there was some kind of case or something that led to one of those cities, you called that person right away because you already knew how it was going to be handled. There weren't going to be any issues. No one was going to try to backdoor anything, and it was just going to be handled the way as if you did it yourself.
Yep. Yep. That brotherhood goes a long way at that point.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned Mokler coming out to LA when you were a young agent, but was there a senior agent that kind of taught you more about being an agent and how to make cases than anybody else?
Yeah, I would say Mike Gunn.
I don't know him.
Yeah, Mike Gunn. He was outstanding. Kevin Merrill, who I know you know from SOD.
Very well.
He was the senior. When I got in my first group, he was the backup in that group. He was a senior agent. And I learned a lot from those two guys. And interestingly, Steve, I didn't have a DEA supervisor until about 8 years into my career.
Wow.
And as crazy as this sounds, and I've told Michelle Lenhart this, I remember telling her this at my retirement, part of the reason why I was successful is I really had, I don't want this to come across the wrong way, but I really didn't have supervision. And sometimes and again, like I said, I don't want it to come across the wrong way. I don't mean we were doing crazy stuff, but I mean, like, there was some stuff that a senior agent would probably tell you, like, that's stupid. Like, don't waste your time doing that. But I had time and I'd put the time in, and all of a sudden, that's what I talked about earlier, like luck, not necessarily luck, but if you put the time in and you do the same thing 100 times and 99 times, it doesn't work. And then that one time it works, you're like, oh, that was worth it for the whole 100 times we did it.
Yeah. I'll be honest with you. I don't believe in luck or coincidence, either one.
No.
I think things happen for a reason. And it's through dedication, hard work, work ethic. There's a lot of different elements that could go into that, I think, that make people successful.
Here's an example of that, Steve. And I already know people are going to be like, oh, you're telling that story again.
Well, I probably haven't heard it.
At that time, so this is 1997, and we were doing, 96 maybe, a case on some Colombians that were really based in Miami, but they would accept loads in L.A., cocaine, and transport it to New York. And we were up on a lot of pager intercepts, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, obviously pager's not a thing anymore, but a lot of pager intercepts. And I'm driving home one evening, and my partner, who's an LA County Sheriff's deputy, he calls me from the wire room and he says, hey, we got this pager intercept. Like, here's the number, like area code 310-946, whatever. And at this time, like, it wasn't like today where numbers are ported and you keep a number with you, like you could tell from an area code and the exchange, the first three digits of the number, about where that number was.
Right.
And then you knew, like, at least in LA, if the last four started with a nine, it was probably a payphone. So again, now I had dealt so much with phone numbers that he told me the number and I go, that's probably a payphone at LAX. And I said, hey, now this is how stupid this is, Steve. Like, I'm driving literally by LAX to get home at the beach. LAX is on the water in west side of LA, southwest side of LA. And I said, let me swing in the airport, LAX, and let me see what's there. And I also knew from doing a lot of these cases that Carnival Airlines, you remember that airline from Miami, or was it?
Yeah.
Carnival Airlines was like the big Colombian airline. If you were flying from Miami to LA, you were going to be on Carnival Airlines, and they flew into the Bradley terminal at LA. So like, this is something that if I had asked my supervisor and said, hey, I'm going to go to LAX and I'm going to go to the Carnival, I'm going to go to the Bradley terminal and look for a crook, What would any sane supervisor say? They'd be like,
what are you thinking, boy?
Yeah. So I pull off, I go in the, I park the G-Ride, I walk into the Bradley terminal, I walk up to a payphone, that's not the number. I look at the payphone next to it, Steve, and that's the number.
Oh, that's the number
the guy called. Now, is that lucky? Well, I kind of, a little bit, but I knew it was a payphone. I knew it was probably at LAX. I knew they'd be flying Carnival Air. And then I look up and there's these guys with, at that time, my Spanish is worse than it is today, but I could tell a Cuban accent. And so I called the guy in the wire room. I'm like, hey, man, there's some Cubans here that are real loud. And I think they just got off this flight and they're looking around. And then they went and got on a shuttle bus to a hotel. And okay, I drove over to the hotel later. And the guy, and I describe them, and the guy at the hotel is like, no, those guys, we didn't see anybody like that. He says, but what people do is they'll ride the shuttle bus here and then they'll go across the street and rent a car at the car rental place. So long story short, go to the car rental place. Yes, they saw the guys. We get all the information. We find out the hotel they're staying at. We set up on them the next morning and boom, that day they take delivery of 200 kilos and we hit it out on the freeway leaving town. And that was the thing where, I don't remember who the guy was, but the guy from headquarters is like, yeah, that's pretty lucky. But like I said, Mokler kind of understood.
Right.
He understood that I went there for a reason. And it was years of doing this stuff that I could kind of predict, like, oh, a guy's coming to LA. He's at a payphone. He's a Miami case. He's probably going to be at where this airline comes in. And you can kind of create your own luck if you're not afraid to waste time sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That 2-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
And Moke, I tell you what, Bill Mokler was, he's such a legend. At one point when I was in SOD, I took over the training program for, I don't know, a year or two. And they're teaching officers and agents how to do wiretaps. But we were also introducing the internet intercept program, all that. Mm-hmm. And Bill's one of my contractors. And here I'm a GS-14, first level supervisor.
Right.
And I'm thinking, man, I'm in the great presence of royalty here, DEA royalty, and I'm going to question his voucher.
Yeah. And he's no longer with us. And I did speak to him many, many times after that. Again, he was still a contractor when I was at SOD, but I wish I really told him the impact that he had on me and just that, hey, it's okay to do this crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Just keep doing it.
He was a true leader of men.
Yeah.
Let's see here. When you were in LA, now you're doing a lot of wiretap. Did you ever do any undercover work?
A little bit. Not much. I mean, hey, I would do a little undercover work if we wanted to get compartments put in cars. I did that probably also in the late 90s, but not really. The raves, whenever there was a rave going before I was a supervisor, some kind of big electro dance party or something, I would jump in on that, but no, not my forte.
Yeah. We even doing out, when you're out doing surveillance, that's a form of undercover work. Those that work deep in DEA, there's not a lot of people who have worked deep cover. Not like the Joe Pistones, it was Donnie Brasco in the Bureau and that kind of thing. And I mentioned him because Joe's one of my close personal friends.
Yeah.
But I'm just in awe of Joe because it's funny because we'll go, he and I are honorary members of the board of directors for the Southern California Gang Conference down in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And every May, end of May, they have a conference, week-long conference. That's actually where these shirts came from. They don't pay you anything, but they throw shirts at me and I work for free and I'm pretty cheap and easy. But just hanging out with him, people say, well, can we ask you some questions about the Escobar investigation? Well, sure you can. And then invariably somebody will say, you had such an exciting career. Who do you ask when you have questions? And I point at Joe. That's the man. This guy, I've known him for 8, 9, 10 years now. We were together just a few weeks ago in San Diego, and then we came up to LA for some stuff. And I'm still hearing stories from him that I've never heard before. The guy's just a true legend. So, yeah. Joe, love you, brother. Thank you for being a friend and for sharing everything with us.
Man, and Steve, that deep cover stuff is a whole different world. I have some buddies that were ATF that did all that deep cover on the motorcycle gangs, and that's a whole different thing.
Yeah. John Carr, is that one of your friends?
John Carr, a.k.a. Rambo. I still keep in touch with him.
Yeah.
Steve, one time we were, hey, I don't know, do you know how he used to dress?
No.
Now, this is the early 90s, right?
Okay.
So he would wear, I don't remember, I was working at the task force in L.A. in the early 90s, and I don't know if he, I don't think he was assigned there, but he would be over there a lot. And he would show up with like a bandana around the head here, and then a olive green vest with no shirt under it. And he's a big dude, right? And he had long hair at that time, long hair. And we went in a coffee shop. I went in a coffee shop with him next to the task force office. And the girl's looking at him behind the counter and looking at him behind the counter. And she says, I know you. And he says, oh, you do? She says, yeah, you Rambo, John J. Rambo. You John Rambo. Because he looked like Rambo from Sly Stallone movie.
Yeah. That's hilarious. I got to get him on the show. I've had a lot of the ATF guys on here, especially the ones that work bikers, and I haven't had John on, but I got to get him on here. So,
hey, even in his late career, when he was on his extension, he still did undercover for us. We did some arms trafficking stuff with CJNG targets, and he set up the warehouse, and he's such an expert at that stuff.
Wow.
That he would still be the guy we would call in 2023. So 30 years after he started doing it, he's still doing undercover.
That's respect.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
So in your career, what's the biggest risk that you ever took out on the street?
Oh, man. It didn't end well, Steve.
Uh-oh.
We were doing a pretty simple heroin buy bust. This is when I was a supervisor, and it was myself, a task force officer, and then another task force officer, DEA. So anyway, the surveillance got split up, and there were four of us that kind of went with this target, and we saw him pick up the dope, and he had about a four-year-old kid with him, and he was at a park, and walking back to the car, and we knew, I don't remember the exact circumstances, but we knew he had the dope with him. And we thought, hey, there's four of us here. We had one, two. I don't remember if we had three cars. I think one agent and TFO were doubled up in one car. If I remember, we had three cars. And as a supervisor, I made the call, which was not very bright, which was, hey, let's take him down right here. He's walking to his car in the park. He's got the dope on him. Let's do it. So he got back to the car before we could get in there, and he fled in the car with the four-year-old, hit one of the TFO's cars, and we had a full-blown, you know, chase across LA, and he actually got away from us. And man, I just remember being so frustrated with myself. When I guess a little bit of complacency, right? You're like, hey, we got four people. We can arrest this one guy. And yeah, you can if he's going to be compliant, but this guy wasn't. And it took, we eventually, I give credit to one of the guys that was in the group because he kind of made it his mission to catch this guy. And it took about a better part of a year, but we finally located the guy and arrested him on that case. But yeah, that was something looking back where that was, didn't seem too risky at the time, but was a little bit risky and something we probably shouldn't have done.
Well, we all say hindsight's 20/20.
Yep.
And when you're on the street there, you're making the calls and you're doing it based on experience and circumstances and what your manpower is and so forth. There's a lot of variables that go into making that decision, but you got to make it quickly.
Yeah. And if you look at it, you think, and probably this is me justifying it, but if you look at it in terms of like a uniform guy, if there was one, like that's something where a uniform cop would just roll up one-on-one probably. And we had four. That's what I'm thinking. There's four of us. We can easily do this. He's got a little kid with him. He's not going to fight. He's not going to flee. Well, he did.
Surprise. Surprise, surprise.
Yep.
Oh, man. I want to mention also here with Billy's career, later on, he became recognized as a subject matter expert, an SME, on the business and financial dealings of transnational criminal organizations. And this guy has testified and as an expert witness, which I was a cop for 38 years. I never got qualified as an expert witness. And he did that in several state and federal courts. So that's a big deal. I mean, we're talking about a guy who has the experience. He has the expertise, but he's earned the respect of the courts also, because when you go in as an expert witness, trial attorneys do their best to beat you down.
Oh, yeah.
I can't imagine the questioning, the voir dire that you went through to get that expert witness sign next to your name.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that I still do a little bit today. I did a case recently, a civil case regarding the California Angels. They were sued by the family of Tyler Skaggs, the pitcher who died of a fentanyl overdose. And I testified on behalf of the family. The only work I do in that genre, Steve, is on behalf of victims. That's it.
Good for you.
You know, and to the subject matter expert stuff, hey, I'm not into the soap opera side. Like there's probably a GS-12 out there that could tell you the families and who's related to who. And we have some phenomenal experts in LA on that stuff, especially CJNG. There's a guy, Kyle Morey, who knows everything about CJNG, the families, who's related to who, how they started.
Wow.
That's not really my thing. My thing is kind of the business side of it. Like why these groups, why traffickers do what they do, the motivations for kind of switching to different types of drugs that they traffic, what's going on in the drug market. And really, that's kind of my love, is just the business of narcotics trafficking. And outside of DEA, you really can't do an awful lot of that unless you get involved in television stuff or somewhere where someone wants to kind of hear that stuff. So it's not going to help me in a corporate security gig knowing how drug trafficking groups operate.
Yeah. Well, it's worked out pretty well for you. We're going to talk about that here just a little bit. And I mentioned earlier that you rose up through the ranks of becoming the special agent in charge of the LA Field Division. And just give the listeners an idea of the geographical area of responsibility you have as the LAFD special agent in charge.
Yeah. So it's the seven counties that make up the greater LA area. So I shouldn't say, I guess that's what it's called. So that's to the north, San Luis Obispo County, all the way down to Orange County, and east to the Nevada border, San Bernardino, Riverside, LA, Ventura counties. And then interestingly, the state of Nevada, the state of Hawaii, and the territories Guam and Saipan. And really, although I guess a lay person might hear that and kind of think, man, that's kind of a crazy, area of responsibility. Like, what sense does that make? Well, even to this day, the trafficking patterns kind of dictate that. If you're in Vegas, the drugs are likely coming from LA. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot coming from Phoenix, but a lot come from LA. Same thing with Hawaii. The drugs in Hawaii traditionally come from LA. So it's a lot easier to coordinate an investigation with those outer offices when the leadership is under one roof. So it actually does make sense. But man, the drug issues, a lot different in Reno, Nevada than it is in, Riverside, California.
Right. And there's a DEA office in Guam. Is there one in Saipan?
So there was when I was there, and again, I'm 2.5 years out, there was a post of duty in Saipan.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a lot of responsibility there.
Yeah.
So based on and I want to get to some different questions here a little bit now, and these will continue on into tomorrow, but what, in your opinion, what would shock the public most about how DEA actually operates?
Probably the shock the public the most. Probably the money laundering side of things, that DEA is so involved in attacking money laundering with undercover operations, and how they use undercover money laundering operations to identify networks, get on the drug side of things, and really have major impact on criminal organizations. I don't think that, although you hear a lot about money laundering, I don't think the public is so aware of the breadth of some of the undercover stuff that's done in New York and LA and everywhere, probably everywhere. Although I think it's toned down a bit in the past couple of years, a pretty significant piece that flies under the radar a lot of times.
Before you retired, did they still have the Attorney General exempted organization authorizations?
Yes.
And ladies and gentlemen, what that does is that gives the investigators and the agencies they work for the authority to let funds walk. And we're talking money. We're not talking drugs here, okay? But the purpose is, and even if you're, we may have agents acting as the money launderer who is collecting a percentage of the funds that he is laundering for the bad guys. I know that sounds strange. It always did to me. When I was a young agent, I had a real hard time justifying that in my mind. But what it does is it allows the investigators to identify more components within that organization so that you're not just taking off one money laundering cell. You're tracking it back to find additional assets, whether they're financial assets or homes or jewelry or paintings or whatever the assets might be. And you're trying to continually go up that ladder to get to the head of this organization. So, but Billy, I think I saw where you'd made a comment here recently, like in the last couple of days. And ladies and gentlemen, we're recording this the third week of June. It's coming out in July. But there was an article I read yesterday about an agent, I think in Phoenix, who was he filed whistleblower status against DEA because he was saying that I didn't read what he was saying DEA, but the U.S. Attorney's Office was allowing loads of fentanyl to hit the street.
Oof.
Did you read that?
I didn't.
Oh, okay. You must have made a comment. I know you've done a lot of talks on fentanyl and the dangers and so forth, but man, I hope that's not true.
I do too. I mean, you got to be so, yeah, that's you got to be so careful with that. For a while, I mean, DEA had a prohibition. This is probably around when fentanyl really started kind of hitting 2016, 17, 18, sometime in that area, DEA had a prohibition against even doing controlled deliveries of fentanyl.
Right.
And I don't know, I don't think that still holds today, but yeah, that's no good. And hey, back to the money laundering thing. What I used to tell people is the goal of an undercover money laundering investigation is not to launder money.
Yeah.
And really, that's the truth. Like, you got to be so ratios, right? You got to have good ratios, the amount of money laundered versus what you're getting from it.
Yeah.
So try to launder as little as possible and try to actually maximize the return, what you're getting out of it.
There you go. It's not, trust me, it's not done lightly. And we're going to talk probably tomorrow about your movie and TV career, but I do want to ask you one question now. What is it that you think that movies consistently get wrong about federal narcotics investigations? And you're the man with experience.
Yeah, man, that's a good question. I think they miss the complexity a lot. And yeah, there are simple cases out there, but even the simple cases are, if the job's being done correctly, are tied into bigger networks. And one thing that always shocks me, not really, or that shocks people, I should say, not really on the scripted side of television, but like on the documentary side, is they're blown away by how long it takes from the initiation of an investigation until the case is fully adjudicated in court.
Right.
A year and a half of the person in custody still negotiating a plea, getting discovery, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's something that the public they think it's, hey, the guy's arrested, the case is done. Man, there's a lot that happens after the arrest that drags on forever and ever. And the other thing that's probably missed, I'm just going to be real, is the sometimes strained relationship between agents and prosecutors. Like, hey, a lot of times as a federal agent, you develop a relationship with a prosecutor and there's mutual trust and you don't have issues getting cases filed, charges filed. But a lot of times, it's sometimes a challenge. You feel you have the evidence, the prosecutor doesn't. And the reality is probably somewhere in the middle there. But it's probably, if you talk to agents today around the country, I would guess that that would be one of the major frustrations that they have, is getting cases prosecuted. And again, it depends on leadership of U.S. attorney's offices, which changes regularly with changes in administration. All the U.S. attorneys are out. All new U.S. attorneys come in, different priorities. If the attorney general sends out a memo saying he doesn't want minimum mandatory drug cases charged, that's a problem for DEA agents, right? Because that's what we do. So I think that's something that is often missed, is that sometimes, I don't know, probably contentious is too strong a word, but the sometimes strained relationship between cops and prosecutors.
Absolutely. Cops and other cop agencies.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah.
I hate that.
And even the same agency, Mike Chavarria's book, Junior, talks about the issues with other, sometimes you hit bumps in the road with other DEA offices. That's just how it is. That's why relationships are so important. Trusted relationships are so important.
Yeah. And had Mike on the show here a few months ago talking about his new book. That's a guy that I just have the utmost respect for. It's the things that he did in Mexico. I mean, there's just so many studs and studettes at DEA. It is in all federal law enforcement. But on this particular question, I think a lot of people base their knowledge on what DEA is or does based on what they see on television and fiction movies or a TV show where the crime's committed and 42 minutes later, but we take commercials out, 42 minutes later, it's solved and they're moving on to the next case.
Yeah.
And that's not what happens. This is just not what happens. So,
right.
What is it that you think is the biggest mistake that young agents make?
I think, and again, my experience is going to be different just because of where I worked, et cetera. But I think probably trying to rush into things a little bit, trying to do the biggest thing first. And there's so much to learn, and just patience and listening and kind of do the grunt work for a little bit is what I would say, how I would kind of describe it.
Yep.
Everything else will come with it, but kind of work on the foundation. And the one thing I always tell new agents, and I feel like maybe even more than what I just said, that this is a thing. You, to be successful as a DEA agent, you have to have a sense of urgency. Because it's very different than a lot of types of, almost all other types of federal crime, Steve. Think about what a DEA agent does. They have to figure out where a crime is going to be committed, when it's going to be committed. They have to be there when the crime is committed and collect evidence while the crime is being committed. And sometimes they're even going to do that in a way where the crooks don't even know you were there. Like, that type of proactive investigation is very different than any other type of crime. I'm not saying it's harder or easier or whatever. I look at how FBI does bank robberies. Basically, they categorize them and they have nice nicknames for them. And, hey, no heat from my FBI friends. And they get a guy and they can link him to 13 bank robberies that he did. That's great. But you really, imagine if you could not prosecute a crime unless you were there when the crime is committed. That's what DEA does every day. And in order to do that and be successful, you have to have a sense of urgency. You can't say, I could write this warrant today, but I don't know. I might not need it. Let me just wait. Write the warrant. If you don't serve it, you don't serve it, but have that warrant in your pocket. And man, I wrote a lot of search warrants that were never, ever served, but I had it in my pocket and I knew if something happens at this house, we can hit it instantly and have no issue. And that's one thing that I used to implore on the new agents. And I also used to tell them there's a lot of freedom in the job of a DEA agent, right? So you better find your little niche. It's great. As we want a new agent to do everything. And that's, you're going to have to do that. You're going to have to learn how to do everything, but it's okay to find a little niche doing something that you love and become an expert at that.
At one point when I started the strike force in Atlanta, Rob Murphy was one of my GSs, and the way he ran his group, and they were one of the most successful enforcement groups, I would put him up against just about anybody in the United States. I love Rob to death, man.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
He talks very highly. We had lunch last week. We were in Atlanta visiting our children, and he and I always get together for a meal when I go up there. But I would say, okay, you got 12 agents. Tell me what each one of them is doing, because all I'm seeing is two or three casemakers. And he said, I can't have a casemaker. Everybody's not a casemaker.
That's it.
If you got one or two casemakers, everybody else plays a support role that's just equally as important. And here I was already a GS-15. My simple way of looking at things is, hey, if this redneck hillbilly can go out and make a case as a case agent, every agent should be able to do that. But then you look at the significant qualities of the cases that his group was making. You needed all those personnel working together with under that one case agent or maybe two case agents to have a successful conclusion, because they were just kicking butt and taking names.
Yep.
So proud of what those people did. And I'm looking on my list of prior interviews here, and I can't remember who told me this recently, but the statement was, as an agent, within your first 3 years, that's when you're going to make your name for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually something that, so at one time when I was a SAC, I had Kurt Palin as a deputy SAC, him and Mike Davis, and we used to, all three of us would sit in my office and meet the new agents as they came in, and Kurt would tell them that every single time. He would say, your reputation is made your first 3 years.
Yep.
And for good or for bad, that's going to follow you the rest of your career. So remember that. And in your interactions, remember that, in how you treat people and communicate and your willingness to work crazy hours. Remember that. Man, when I worked on a good team, if you didn't get a call, if the group went out and worked at night and they didn't call you, hopefully you were pissed off. You were pissed off. Like, you were mad that you didn't get the call to go out and work. I mean, that's kind of the way it should be.
Yeah. When I was a young agent in Miami there in the late 80s, if our group wasn't going out, we went to the other enforcement groups. Hey, y'all got anything going on tonight we can come out and help with you with?
Yep.
Yeah, it doesn't really do a whole lot for your family life, but
no.
Man, it was exciting.
But that goes back to what I was saying earlier about addiction. It's not necessarily work ethic. It's not necessarily healthy. I remember being like a 13 in LA, and there was another guy who was a 13 who was going on vacation to a very, I don't want to say too many specifics, Steve. He was going on vacation to a very exotic spot regularly. And everyone was like, wow, that's cool. He's going on these vacations there. He goes there all the time. And I was like, what? That's so stupid. Like, what could he possibly be doing on vacation that's more fun than what we're doing here? I said that with a straight face. Like, it just didn't make sense to me that someone would want to do something else other than play this game that we were playing, that we played as a kid, but now we were doing it in the real world. It just didn't compute to me that someone would want to take a vacation from that. It made no sense. So hence why I didn't get married till I was 44, 45 years old, and lived in a one-bedroom apartment by myself, because I just loved the fun of the work so much. Probably looking back, not really healthy, but damn, it was fun.
Yeah. And you were married to the job. You were married.
Yeah.
Just yeah. In a different way, man.
Yeah.
So this is a little bit more of a serious question, and I'm talking about as you progress through the ranks. Did you ever have a point in your career where almost like an aha moment comes along and you realize that your decisions were placing people in positions that could potentially get them killed?
Yeah, I think as a supervisor, I mean, it could be that one incident I already talked about, but I think just as a supervisor in general, hey, in my world, Steve, a GS-7 through GS-12 as crazy as this is going to sound, they really shouldn't be thinking about safety. They should be thinking about what they need to make their case successful. And then at the 13 level, hopefully there's a strong backup in the group. He's going to start interjecting some of that stuff. Like, hey, listen here, knucklehead. Like, I see where you're going with this, but that's a little crazy. And then as you come up through the ranks of 14, you're thinking a little bit bigger picture. It has to be safe. As a 15 now in ASAC, maybe you're thinking about reputational risk and what could happen to big DEA. And as it just, I guess what I'm saying is your decision making has different criteria depending on where you sit in the chain of command. And probably as a 14 is where I learned, I wouldn't necessarily say one incident. It could have been the first time I looked at an ops plan and signed off on it and said, okay, this one's on me. I think as a 14 was the first time I really realized like, hey, this stuff has to be dialed in because these people are relying on me to do my job now. Like their job isn't to think about all this safety stuff. I want them to just be crazy case makers that I have to rein in. My job is to make sure everything now is safe and everything's buttoned up.
Absolutely. And when you're that GS 14 group supervisor and you're out on your street with the guys and the shots are being fired, so a lot of learning goes on during those moments too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So just to follow up on that question a little bit, did you ever experience any episodes where you might wake up in the middle of the night worrying about things that the street agents are doing or thinking, okay, did they think of this? Did they think of that? Not that you're second guessing, but it's just your concern for your people.
100%. I mean, I can't think of any specifics right now, but that's kind of a regular thing. Like when they're out on the, and that was probably more, as a GS, I think I was out there 99% of the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
As an ASAC is when that phenomena comes up because you know there's a group out there, you haven't heard anything, you're starting to think what's going on. Maybe you fall asleep and you wake up and the first thing you do is reach for your phone and you say, shit, they still haven't called me. What's going on? So
yeah,
I think as an ASAC is kind of when second line supervisor is when that kind of sets in and you start worrying about those things and what's happening because you're not, hey, if you're there and doing it, you're good. You're not thinking about calling your boss as you know, but the boss who's laying home in bed, he's thinking about what you're doing. So yeah.
Did you ever get a phone call at dark 30 in the middle of the night? Cause those aren't good phone calls.
Man, I got one. This was when, I wasn't married yet, but I was dating my wife and it was in the evening, and I remember just putting fish on the grill. And John Poulin calls me, and he says, hey, boss, we just had a shooting here in Studio City. And I said, come on, stop effing with me, right? Mm-hmm. And he, no, boss, we had a shooting. You probably have to come out here. And I remember telling my wife, or who's my wife now, hey, I got to go. And like watching her brain try to compute, she's like, you just put fish on the grill. Like, yeah. We're about to eat dinner. We just put fish on the grill. And I'm like, that doesn't matter right now. Like, I'm leaving. So that was kind of her first introduction to, because as an ASAC, your hours are somewhat regular, right?
Right.
And that's the position I was in for the most part when we were dating. But yeah, those calls come and you kind of, as you know, you kind of drop everything. And that's the reality of the job.
Yeah. And here's one tough question, and then we'll probably call it break here for today, and this is a tough question. Tell us about the worst phone call or home visit that you've ever had to make to a family member.
And easy question. It was, man, Steve, I'm going to be embarrassed that I think the agent's last name was Markey. He was killed in Venezuela. It was like a robbery at a gas station. I think he was there on vacation. This would have been 2006, like the early part of 2006. And Steve Delgado was the SAC. And this agent's parents lived north of LA, like somewhere around Santa Barbara. And he called me up and said, Bodner, can you do this? Can you go out and notify this agent's family that he was killed? And I did that night, man. And that's rough. To have to do that is rough, and to see the emotion from the family and the questions and everything else, tough to do.
It is. When I was a uniform cop back in the 70s, had to make one death notification, and I just don't know any easy way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, you talk to some of these guys, my former co-host on here, Morgan Wright, made several death notifications throughout his law enforcement career. And it's one of those things that never gets easier, because you're delivering bad news, and the family knows that if you show up, something's probably really wrong.
Yeah. And forgive me if I got the name wrong. It's embarrassing that I don't remember it, but yeah, that was rough.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't tell our guests what questions I'm going to ask them, and you kind of put people on the spot, and you can understand that. I tell you what, man, my memory is not nearly as good as it used to be. Multitasking abilities are not quite as good as they used to be. There's a medication out there that supposedly helps you with your memory to help. So your memory will maybe recoup a little bit.
Let me guess. You forgot what it was.
I can't remember the name of the damn drug.
Right. I knew that was coming. Right.
Oh, Bill, man, thank you so much for letting me put you on the spot with some of these questions, because it's I'm taking out some of the pauses, ladies and gentlemen. Some of these questions I ask, you have to stop and just think about them for a few minutes before you come up with the answer that you want to. You want to give the best the best answer that you can here. So thank you, brother. Bill has agreed to come back tomorrow, so I certainly hope that you will come back and join us. We're going to get into a little bit more about drug enforcement. I got one really, really good question. I can't wait to hear your answer on this, because I know if anybody in DEA has a good answer to this, it's going to be you, Billy. But we also want to get into what he's doing in Hollywood, because I just think that's so exciting. And of course, we're going to go with our rapid fire round. So we're going to have some fun tomorrow. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for continuing to come back every week to support the Game of Crimes. I couldn't do any of this without you. If you're listening to this and you haven't watched us on YouTube yet, do me a favor, go over to YouTube, type in Game of Crimes Podcast in that search bar at the top. Click on the subscribe button. Meet some of the guests that you've been listening to. Click on the like button if you like what they're saying, and send me your comments. Until tomorrow, everybody, stay safe. We'll see you then.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.